Okay, welcome to another section of the class. In this section, we'll focus a lot on the dynamics of the recovery process itself. By this time, most people are kind of grateful to have moved out of the description of the problem section. So I, however, have more anxiety about this section than any of the others for some reason, because it's just when it gets right down to it, trying to figure out what actually constitutes recovery from abuse turns out to be extremely complicated, both because there's so many kinds, manifested in so many different stages of life and all the stuff we've been talking about so far. But I think there are some generally useful things that can be said about recovery process. I'm going to try to give an overview today and look at several different frames for thinking about the dynamics of recovery, and then we'll look more closely at three different sort of frames of reference for the recovery process in the coming days. Coming up with models for recovery is, something that academics do and scholarly folks are inclined to. People actually in the process of recovery don't necessarily think about it as being, fitting into a pattern of some kind. And there's good reason for that. The experience itself is so unique and so distinctive to our own life experiences and how we've experienced the same. I mean, even two people who experience the same kind of abuse at the same life stage, the likelihood that they'll have the same sort of reaction to that is very small. You have to back up to some significant distance to start seeing patterns. But still, I think it's useful to be thinking about that. I think it's helpful in strategic planning for a ministry in the local church in particular. That's the emphasis I'm going to be trying to be making today. This is not the kind of lecture I'd make if we were sort of all therapists in training and I was talking about, what recovery stuff looked like when it's facilitated by the help of a therapist. It's a rather different topic and also a very complicated one. There's lots of different things that are helpful and lots of things that aren't. But I think my focus here this week and next week is really what sort of ways of thinking about the recovery process help us to do ministry design in the local church. How would you shape the identity of a local church to be both safe for and helpful to people recovering from all the different kinds of abuse we've talked about? That's the central goal, creating safe places and helpful places, helpful strategies that you can actually implement in the local church context. Now, probably the most common instinct about models for recovery has to do with different kinds of instinct about stages. Different stages of the recovery process, and it's perfectly understandable that people might try to figure that out. And in the Judith Herman book that I have you read, she does a good job, I think, of historically, I think this chart comes from her actually, looking at people historically who have conceptualized recovery from traumatic events as fundamentally a three-step process. And usually the first stage involves stabilization. She calls it safety. I think it's a better word than stabilization, because even when you're safe, you can have a lot of volatility going on. But safety is the sort of place where recovery starts. No one's going to do anything else in recovery if they don't have a sense of safety, a kind of a stable place on which, some kind of foundation on which to build. It has to start there. It makes a lot of sense. And the second stage is quite different. It's sort of the I rather liked Putnam's word about metabolism of trauma. It's sort of all that sort of processing of trauma in various ways. And for some people, it's exploring or re-experiencing. She focuses on remembrance and mourning, which is a very helpful frame for thinking about this middle period where it's safe enough to begin to look at and to remember and to mourn, to grieve. So it's a lot of grief work and all the dynamics of that here in this middle stage. And then there's a third stage, historically typically called integration of some kind, where you're fitting all the learning from this into other aspects of life. She calls it reconnection, which is a little bit more specific than some of the earlier conceptualizations. But it's about, again, sort of moving on somehow to integrating whatever learning's taking place in the first two stages into a broader parts of one's life. Like any other way of conceptualizing the recovery process, a kind of a stages model has strengths and weaknesses. The strengths of conceptualizing it as, for example, a three-stage process is its simplicity. There are sort of stages models out there. One comes to mind that had 23 different stages to it, which sort of doesn't add much simplicity to the process. It just feels like this laundry list of tasks that have to be done somehow, and in the real world, they're all jumbled up in all kinds of orders. And the main reason to have a model of some kind, a conceptual model, I think, is to facilitate simplicity. It's like simple enough that you can keep it in the back of your mind, and it really helps when you're thinking about ministry, I think. It's probably not going to make sense to start an abuse recovery ministry and have it be for everybody. Because you would do very different things with people who are in the first stage, where safety is the essential, than you would do for people in the second stage, where remembrance and mourning, for example, is the centerpiece of things. You can't do the remembrance and mourning without being re-traumatized if you don't do the safety first. So you might want a strategy for helping people in that early stages where safety is, it's okay to be in pain, this is a safe place to be struggling, you don't have to talk. All that kind of things is stuff you might do to facilitate first stage recovery. Later on, when people have some sense of this is a safe place, you can move on to to talking about remembrance and mourning, those kinds of things. But you don't expect one ministry strategy to be meeting the needs of everybody in this multi-stage process. That's the advantage of thinking of it in stages like this. The disadvantages of thinking of recovery as staging is, as I just said, in the real world, it's just really complicated. And just because you have acquired a sense of safety and sort of successfully feel like you've successfully completed the first stage of recovery from trauma or abuse doesn't mean that later on you aren't thrust back into that same need to reclaim a safe base. So it's not really distinct stages. These things overlap a lot, and there's a lot of movement back and forth between stages. It makes it conceptually, I think, pretty complicated. A few generalizations about models, other models, that I think are illustrated as well by thinking about a stages of recovery model. First, that models are always over simplifications, and we saw in the case of stages models. They're always oversimplification because there just isn't any one-size-fits-all kind of recovery pathway. They need to be adapted to unique circumstances, unique people, unique experiences. And oversimplifications can be extraordinarily useful for us. I really like things that boil stuff down to 3 points because I can keep that in my mind. I can sort of keep track of that. If it's 6 points, I always have to refer to the piece of paper which has the six things listed on it, right? And all of us need that kind of tools that are not so complicated that we forget things. So I think the fact that they're oversimplifications is not a bad thing. I think it's part of the reasons that they're helpful. Second point about models is the importance of remembering, at least carrying a pretty healthy dose of pragmatism with you into this. What works is what works, and if it doesn't fit the model, hey, what works works. And I think you'd get yourself in trouble with that. But it's also, I think, very helpful in most circumstances to remember that if something's working for somebody, even if it doesn't, you know, fit my preconceptions of how this is supposed to look like, that's okay. This is actually particularly important because you will observe, if you work very much with survivors of abuse, that people who have gone through a recovery process, and actually this is true whether we're talking about recovery from abuse or addiction or trauma, people who have gone through a recovery process often think that the way other people ought to recover is just the way I recovered. Now, it's a pretty natural, normal, instinctual kind of response. When you benefited from something enormously, you think other people ought to do the same thing and receive the same benefits. And, you know, maybe so, but maybe not so. That's one of the reasons why pragmatism helps. Someone does, you know, heads along the same path you were on, and may or may not have the same sort of response to it. And you need to find some way to make that be okay. Models, all of them, tend to start with a particular way of understanding what the problem is. That is, they're problem centric, which I think is a good thing, necessary thing. And they sort of move from a conceptualization of the problem onto a conceptualization of the solution. What I'm going to do for the rest of our time today is look at, I think I got 7 or 8 different ways, sort of frames in which people talk about the recovery process. I'm just going to make brief comments about 7 of those, and then we're going to take the last 3, and we'll spend a whole lecture on each of them because, well, for a variety of different reasons. But let's talk about these one at a time. The first sort of way of framing the problem of abuse that results in different sort of recovery strategies is that the central problem is traumatic memories. And, you know, if you're experiencing traumatic memories, you're experiencing intrusive memories, memories that just kind of assault you, they come out of nowhere like flashbacks, it's very disorganizing, very disruptive, and it would be perfectly understandable if that seemed like the main problem. It's the memories that are just sort of messing up your ordinary life. And you might gravitate towards a recovery process that focuses on something like healing of memories. In the Christian context, there's quite a lot of ministries out there that are focused on the healing of memories. Now, it's certainly a very real problem. And, you know, the sort of ministry strategies that emerge by focusing on that problem vary a lot from, you know, things that do more harm than good to things that do a lot more good than harm. So it's not about sort of quality of the outcomes here that I want you to focus on. I want you to think about, well, if you were doing work with people and the central problem seemed to be traumatic memories, what are the kinds of things that you do that would be most helpful? Well, you might sort of initially want to combine it with Gustage's model and ask, well, how do you do safety around traumatic memories? And then, before you actually focus on the content of the memories, how do you create situations where it's safe to actually focus on the content? But it's certainly a way of developing ministry strategies for people recovering from abuse that can be very helpful. After all, one of the central sacraments in the Christian tradition is a service of memory, right? Do this in remembrance of me. And the sacrament of communion can be very powerfully used to help people who are recovering abuse and who are focusing on this need for memories to be healed. A way to frame a communion service, for example, would be to say, all of us have memories. Some of us have very traumatic memories. And all of our memories compete inside of us to be the most powerful memories. And the question here at the table today is, which are the memories that are going to shape who we are? And because God has offered us a memory, knowing that this memory will have to do battle with all the other memories in us that are competing for our attention. And so we're here as a community because we know we're still on the field of battle. And we want to remind each other of how important it is that God has provided us a memory of His love for us in Jesus. And while we know how competitive the competition for our attention can be, and how powerful some of our memories are, we want to call ourselves again to this table to remember the memory that God would want to be the most powerful memory of all, the one that shapes us, the one that guides us in our lives in many different ways. Okay, that's a way that you would do in a worship service, a kind of healing of memories kind of exercise, is sort of shaped in that way. And now that may or may not work in your particular tradition, but you know, things like that could be developed that focus specifically around memory as the frame for helping people who have been abused. Second thing I want to talk about is idolatrous attachments. If you identify idolatrous attachments as the problem, then the emphasis for recovery strategies is going to be some sort of spiritual transformation. I already, the whole lecture that I gave on distorted images of God and attachment to gods who are not God was really about this, that as part of the experience of abuse, as part of the experience of recovery from abuse, you find yourself doing battle not just with the sort of psychological level consequences of abuse, but with our attachments to spiritual forces of various kinds that reinforce the pathology rather than lead us to freedom. So if you're, you know, the hero in an addicted family and you're attached to the god of impossible expectations, you're not going to recover by just sort of getting more reasonable expectations of oneself. You're also going to have to deal with the fact that you live in the worship and service of this god of impossible expectations, who's going to be shaming you for every step of the recovery journey. Now, the advantage, I think, of this way of framing the problem is that it takes you quite quickly down to a pretty serious level of stuff. Spiritual transformation is never at the surface of things. And it resonates, I think, very deeply for people who are already people of faith, that they sort of know that something needs to get restructured that's quite fundamental inside of them. And this gives them a way of talking about this. Every frame for thinking about the recovery dynamic has its risks and problems. There are fairly substantial ones here. Particularly, I would say, for people who have experienced a lot of spiritual abuse, they may think that this is just another, this sort of, not only am I harmed by being raped, but now I'm being blamed for having idolatrous attachments, and so it can slip into a blame kind of frame, which is sort of disastrous for recovery process. It's also true that I think in many parts of the Christian tradition at the beginning of the 21st century, spiritual transformation is understood largely as being the kind of thing that happens in very short time frames. So, if you serve a God who's not God, come forward, renounce your spiritual attachments at the altar in front and receive Jesus as your Lord and Savior, and tomorrow morning everything's fine. even if we would not say it that way, the sort of implication that this can be taken care of fairly quickly is pretty deeply embedded, I think, in the Christian tradition. And anything that implies this can be done quickly, I think, is particularly dangerous. And so if it's not possible to unpack stuff in that frame of reference without communicating shame on you for not being better now, shame on you for not really, you know, for trusting gods that aren't God, if it becomes a blame or a shame thing, it becomes a pretty high-risk venture at that point. Third sort of frame, it has to do with cognition. It's the notion that because of abusive experiences, we have believed lies. We have believed things that aren't true. And what we need to do, therefore, as part of the recovery process, is to identify those lies, and so that we can experience some kind of freedom from them. Now, it's undeniably true that trauma, that we learn from traumatic experiences and abusive experiences, things that are not true. I am not wanted. I'm bad. I'm worthless. I'm a burden to other people. All these kinds of lies are very common, and many, many, many others are very common sort of cognitive distortions that you find in people who have experienced abuse or trauma. And sort of identifying those as false is a really helpful part of the recovery process. I'm not myself particularly excited by claims that just fixing stuff at the cognitive level is getting done everything that needs to get done in the recovery process. And there are people who construe recovery dynamics as primarily sort of cognitive restructuring. Instead of believing lies, believe things that are true. And again, strengths and weaknesses. The strengths is that this is a significant piece of the puzzle for lots and lots of people. Having come to some kind of conclusion, some sort of cognitive conclusion about me or about God or about other people, and having to unlearn those lies, try on truer truths, see if life isn't more livable that way. So it can be powerful. It's constrained, like some of these other frames, is that it's just one piece of a bigger package. That is, I don't think anyone really recovers from abuse by just dealing with memory or attachments or cognition. There's got to be other pieces to the puzzle. Maybe you put together enough of these frames, you wind up with something resembling the recovery process. But the danger, again, with one of the dangers of thinking about models here is you'll think that you just need one, whereas putting together three or four gives a much more robust sense of what the recovery process is really like. A fourth thing I want to mention briefly is about boundaries. All abuse involves boundary violations, and developing healthier boundaries is an important piece of the puzzle for any kind of recovery process. So the strengths are really obvious. This has to do, boundaries is almost always about relationships, right? That's where boundaries are important. And I tend to think of it as again, one of the elements that might go into a bigger package of things. There's lots of wonderful things that you can do in the local church context about boundaries. I know the first thing that occurs to everybody is a kind of book study on boundaries, because there's pretty good books out there about it. But think, for example, of Jesus standing at the door and knocking. That metaphor. Picture of what God's like. God is not the one who bursts in, who has a sense of entitlement about being inside. God stands at the door and knocks, and the creator of the universe waits patiently for us to respond. Quite a dramatic image, both at the time in the first century, and I think pretty shocking now too to think of the kind of respectfulness that's embedded in that narrative. So talk about that. Talk about it in the context of, you know, many of us have experienced boundary violations. People have, come in uninvited. And we want to emphasize this morning that God doesn't do that kind of thing. God's very respectful in the way he approaches people. So sometimes he stands at the door and he knocks. I think it's a powerful narrative. It preaches itself. There are some people whose frame about recovery in the context of abuse has to do with identity. That the abuse has kind of captured our identity. And what we need is some kind of new identity. In the Christian context, this often is reflected in language like finding our identity in Christ. Now, it's a bigger sort of frame than memory, attachment, cognition, or boundaries. It's about identity, which might have elements from all those, and that's one of its strengths of conceptualizing it in this way. On the other hand, I'm not sure I quite know what an identity is, you know, so it's a kind of this general conceptual sense. For some people, it's very helpful. And there's a tremendous amount of material in the biblical text, which, if you look at it through this frame, just jumps off the page at you. I read the text recently about Jesus's baptism, and God makes his presence very visibly known. Heaven's open, dove comes down, and he says, "I love this kid. I love this kid. Makes me happy. I love this kid. This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased." That's a far more spiritual way of saying it. I love this kid. It makes me happy. A lot of us were raised in homes where that message was just not there. But this, again, maybe a way to do the sacrament of baptism, or the ritual of baptism, whatever. One way to conceptualize baptism is that it's an event which symbolizes our reception into God's family. We have a new family now. Well, what's this new family like? It's a family where the father in the family feels very comfortable publicly saying, "I love this kid. He makes me happy." If that's not been your experience in life, welcome to a new family. Because that's the kind of thing we say here. This is my son. This is my daughter. Makes me happy. That's what it's like in God's family. So again, that's sort of helping people craft an identity, a different identity from the identity they've acquired from whatever experiences they've had in life. And I think it can sort of inform pastoral practice in really helpful ways. The downside is that it can be a little diffuse and generic, and you have to, there will be some people who will say, well, just like anything else here, people can turn it into a shame and blame thing. You should get your identity in Christ. You're doing something wrong. Shame on you for not, having your roots in the love of God. And as soon as you're into that territory, it doesn't matter the slightest bit what kind of model you have. You're just getting into shame and blame rather than helping people move forward in their recovery process. Just a brief comment about developmental delays. One of the things that traumatic events, particularly in childhood, or the early stages of life, do is that there's developmental delays. I remember first getting hearing a lecture about developmental stages in childhood. I must have been 35, and I remember leaving the lecture hall feeling like I had not successfully accomplished any of the basic goals of any of the stages in life I'd yet experienced. It was like none of them. Safety, identity, you know, I just haven't, you know, and I'm going to have to find some way to go back and experience some kind of reparenting or rechilding or something where there's some sort of remedial experience, because I have these enormous developmental delays. Now, strengths and weaknesses. I think the experience of developmental delays, aged through a period of life without, you know, biologically aged without doing the emotional maturity stuff of that stage in life, is really common for us. But again, it's an opportunity to sort of, you know, shame people, shame on you for acting like a child, you know, and you know, you should be better than that by now somehow. So again, shame and blame doesn't help recovery. And there's always going to be opportunities to do that and that kind of stuff. Finally, a word about unexperienced experiences. I'm thinking of two kinds of things here. One has to do with neglect. Neglect is not something that typically we experience. We don't notice it. It's something that's not there. It's not there to be noticed. And so if there was an absence of affection or an absence of attentiveness or boundaries or appropriate attachments in childhood, we don't experience that as something we didn't have. It's just that's what life is like. There's nothing to see here. This is water to the fish. There's nothing to notice. And so later on in life, we may be exhibiting behaviors that suggest there was trauma or abuse in childhood. And people will ask, well, what happened as a kid? And you come up with nothing. It's just very confusing. I mean, I certainly experienced this very disorienting kind of thought. Well, nothing happened, you know? It was fine. It was what it was. There wasn't anything. I didn't know that it could be different than what it was. Well, none of us, you know, we experience life as it is, not as, you know, one option among 20 options. We just have this one option we're seeing. This is what our family's like. This is what parenting's like. This is what it's like to be a kid in this family. And so it's not really experienced in the sense of I chose this rather than other options, for sure. And so there is a need, I've called it claiming a trauma narrative here. I don't really like that expression, but it's kind of taking ownership of the narrative of neglect, perhaps would be a better way to say that. Taking ownership of a narrative of neglect. Saying, you know, this is really me who has these deficits now, and as a consequence has been accumulating other kinds of deficits in life, and doesn't know how to do some of the things that people without those deficits seem to do pretty easily. That sort of is a way of experiencing experiences that we could not experience as a child. Now there's a second kind of frame of reference for the expression unexperienced experiences. And this has to do with early childhood sexual abuse or physical violence, where the behavior is completely unintelligible. And none of the appropriate affect is accessible. You know, it's my dad that did this, and I love my dad, so I can't hate my dad. I don't have any access to appropriate affect, so I can't really experience what happened here if I'm just really emotionally constrained in the kinds of things that I can experience. And that kind of unexperienced experience often doesn't get turned into a memory, for example. You can have things happen, but it's so unintelligible or so dissonant or so, requires you to experience an affect that's just not possible to be experienced. All those things make it difficult for us to process the experience into something that would correspond, that would be retrievable later as a memory. After all, our memories are not just this sort of videotape that's always going on that watches everything and can be retrieved later the way you would retrieve something from a hard drive. No, I mean, our memories take our experiences and process them in some just really as yet unknown ways, largely, into memories that can be retrieved later. But during times of trauma or abuse, the video camera, if you want to stick with that metaphor, it's like it's in an earthquake. Everything's fuzzy and confusing, and there isn't the records that it's keeping is not always an accurate record or a helpful record of what happened. It's like we didn't quite experience it because there was no way to understand what it was in order to know how to encode that in ways that would be retrievable later. So reclaiming a narrative that has been that we could not form at the time, I think is an important way to frame the recovery process. It's part of a general sense, and this has been much more popular in the recent decades, the sense that recovery is fundamentally a narrative kind of process, that we're finding a healthier way to talk about the arc of our lives. And it's not trying to change what happened, but to have a different way of talking about what happened, a different way to say who we are now because of what happened and who we're going to be in the future because of the past. And that sort of narrative consciousness, I think, is an extremely helpful way to think about the recovery process. It's finding ways of telling the story. At that point, it connects, I think, very deeply with some traditional Christian spiritual disciplines. I'm ordained as a Baptist. May God be merciful. We used to always do testimony, didn't know how to get together as church without doing testimony. And that was testimony is a narrative discipline. It's about telling a story. Now, our testimonies, as I think I talked about in a previous lecture, ranted about a bit, probably get real distorted and real canned and predictable and boring. So it's not always a helpful discipline. One of the things I think that the Christian recovery movement is recovering is this spiritual practice of creating narratives about what God's doing, how God's been active, how I experience God being active or not being active in my life at the present time. That's about how one claims a recovery narrative in that sense. Okay, I think that's all I'm going to talk about, but just let me briefly mention the next three things we're going to focus on. Next time I'm going to talk about forgiveness as a frame for thinking about recovery from abuse. The truth is, I taught this class for many years without ever talking about forgiveness. And the reason was, I wasn't sure that, well, let me just say it this way. If you ask Christians who have been abused about hurtful things that people have said in the Christian community to them, and that were unhelpful to their recovery journey, they will always mention forgiveness first. You should forgive. How come you haven't? What prevents you? It's your obligation. Blah, 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 blah. All that stuff. So I'm hoping in the next lecture to give you a way of thinking about forgiveness, which is a very high priority in the Christian tradition. It's a big deal for us. So we need to have some way of talking about that and navigating that is less hurtful to people in the recovery process. And I think it actually does provide a helpful frame for thinking about what the recovery journey is like under the proper circumstances. And then the following time, we'll talk about the frame of seeing the problem not so much as being inside the brain of a person who's been abused, but as a problem that resides in relationships. What sort of models for recovery would you get to if the problem that abuse represents was between people rather than in people? And I'll just give you one model for thinking about that. And finally, we'll talk about what are the sort of intra-psychic dynamics of the abuse process. My wife will give a lecture, no video for that one, unfortunately, but there'll be an audio lecture with slides, often the best-liked presentation of the class, so don't miss that one. Okay, I think that's all I'm going to talk about today. Lots of stuff here that we can work on in the forum. Which of these frames of reference for thinking about abuse appeals to you the most? Any strengths or weaknesses you'd like to add? Any other models? And this is just, what came to mind. So there's maybe very, very, maybe other very interesting ways to approach this matter. So anyway, I look forward to talking to you about it. Thanks a lot. See you soon.